We stay hungry for them break beats and rhymes. A safe favorite for MCs to shine. I stay tuned in, yeah, all the time. Move them rebels to the grave, stuck in the trees, getting high.
Breaks, beats, and rhymes.
It's nothing but breaks,
beats, and rhymes.
We all about breaks, beats, and rhymes.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Whistleblower Protection Act, aimed at safeguarding whistleblowers and the press who report ethics violations and corruption in government.
Exposing the truth, alerting the public to the government wrongdoing is not a crime and should never be a crime.
A major housing bill passes the Senate with new initiatives to spur affordable housing and limit corporate ownership of homes.
It will make sure that families own those homes, not giant corporations looking to jack up the rent and squeeze every nickel of profit they can.
It heads back to the House, where hardline conservatives vow to kill it. Dublin teachers end a four-day strike for better wages and workplace conditions. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad. Today marks week two of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. The Trump administration's beefing up its military presence in the Gulf as Iran continues fighting back, launching strikes across the region. The U.S. military said it's sending roughly 2,500 Marines and at least one extra warship to the Middle East. Christopher Martinez reports.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth opened the news briefing on Iran, and he did not waste any time getting to the point.
I'll start, as we often do here at the Department of War, with the bottom line up front, for the world to hear and the press to actually admit that the United States is decimating the radical Iranian regime's military in a way the world has never seen before. Never before has a modern, capable military, which Iran used to have, been so quickly destroyed and made combat ineffective, devastated. We said it would not be a fair fight, and it has not been.
He described strikes on more than 15,000 enemy targets, saying Iran now has no air force, no navy, and no air defenses. But the strikes go deeper than that.
Soon and very soon, all of Iran's defense companies will be destroyed. For example, as of 2 days ago, Iran's entire ballistic missile production capacity. Every company that builds every component of those missiles has been functionally defeated, destroyed. Buildings, complexes, and factory lines all across Iran destroyed. So we're shooting down and destroying what missiles they still have in stock, but more importantly, ensuring that they have no ability to make more.
He also referred to the attacks that have killed Iran's supreme leader and other political and military leaders.
Iran's leadership is in no better shape. Desperate and hiding, they've gone underground. Cowering. That's what rats do.
That last comment drew a response from Ali Larijani of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. He posted a message on social media saying, "Mr. Hegseth, our leaders have been and still are among the people, but your leaders on Epstein's Island." Hegseth was joined at the briefing by the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Air Force General Dan Kane. The general briefly mentioned the laundry room fire aboard the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford, and he mourned the loss of a KC-135 refueling aircraft Thursday. But mainly, he praised the military's war successes.
"In just the first 13 days of this operation, our artillery forces have made history. They fired the first precision strike missiles ever used in combat, reaching deep into enemy territory."
He also had praise for the crew that fired the precision strikes.
They then throw three simple toggle switches, and 10 to 15 feet behind them, a rocket motor ignites, and the round is headed downrange to do the nation's work. I asked these youngsters, these young, awesome Americans, what does that feel like? And one of them just looked at me and said, "It's awesome."
During the question period, Secretary Hegseth addressed other issues, like the strike on a girls' school in Iran that killed 175 people, mainly children, apparently by a U.S. Tomahawk missile. Hegseth says that the military's central command has picked an officer to complete an investigation.
The command investigation will take as long as necessary to address all the matters surrounding this incident. And the investigating officer is from outside CENTCOM and is a general officer. But I will note to this group and to the world, there's only one entity in this conflict between us and Iran that never targets civilians.
Hegseth also had some grievances against news reporting on the war. He says the banner headline, "Mideast War Intensifies," for example, would have been better as "Iran Increasingly Desperate."
Another example of a fake headline that I saw yesterday, "War Widening." Here's a real headline for you for an actual patriotic press. How about "Iran Shrinking, Going Underground"? So you see, Iran's leaders are hiding in bunkers and moving into civilian areas. The only thing that is widening is our advantage.
Another issue he touched on was the Strait of Hormuz, the transit route for 20% of the world's oil shipping, as well as other cargo. United Nations officials are warning that disruptions in the strait could disrupt humanitarian aid shipments worldwide. But Hegseth does not seem concerned about that. He says the U.S. will provide military escorts through the strait at some unspecified future time.
"The only thing prohibiting transit in the straits right now is Iran shooting at shipping. It is open for transit should Iran not do that."
Hegseth promised that Friday would see a 20% increase in U.S. strikes on Iran. And indeed, things have escalated on this last Friday of Ramadan. The U.S. is deploying about 2,500 Marines to the Middle East, along with an additional warship. Israel has also ramped up strikes on Iran, as well as escalating military actions in Lebanon. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said Friday, "One thing becomes increasingly clear. We need a convincing plan on how this war can come to an end." But according to Hegseth, the end of the war will come when the U.S. decides its objectives have been met. And that decision is up to one man alone.
"The president has his hand on the throttle and will decide ultimately when they've been reached that serve the purposes of the United States of America, American interests first."
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
U.S. soldiers were killed on a plane crash in western Iraq, killing four soldiers of six impacted. U.S. Central Command, which oversees the Middle East, said the crash followed an unspecified incident involving two aircraft in friendly airspace and that the other plane landed safely. The U.S. military's ruled out hostile fire as a cause for the crash. Meanwhile, Iran launched airstrikes across the region, hitting Saudi Arabia and Oman, killing two Indian nationals today, Oman's first casualties. The strikes came after Iran told its Arab neighbors to close U.S. military bases. Oman houses a U.S. military base. Meanwhile, U.S. Israeli aircraft carried out an airstrike on Tehran today as thousands of people were gathered for the annual state-sponsored Quds Day to support the Palestinian people and call for the destruction of Israel. One strike hit Cafe Downtownism, a special cafe providing employment for workers with autism and Down syndrome, according to the Quds News Network, which shared video of a bombed-out building and people crying out front. Tens of thousands gathered for the annual festival marking the last day of Ramadan. Online video shows people marching through the streets towards a U.S.-Israeli airstrike in the distance, with a billowing cloud of smoke in the air. They start chanting Allah Akbar. Iran's chief justice was among those defiantly in the streets today and spoke to a reporter as another strike occurred.
We, with the people, next to the people, until the last breath, will stand against the aggression.
Explosion, explosion. Sir, as I was speaking to you, there was an airstrike.
People are not scared of this. They've come here under a hail of airstrikes.
Iranian media reporting at least one woman killed by shrapnel. This week, President Donald Trump was asked about the possibility of negotiating with Iran, and he said he had heard Tehran wanted to talk badly. But Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Esmail Begay told DropSite News' Jeremy Scahill the U.S. can no longer be trusted at the negotiating table following both Operations Midnight Hammer and Epic Fury.
Do you think any Iranian with common sense would be really in a position to reach out to the United States under these circumstances? We were negotiating with the United States. In just 9 months, in the course of less than 1 year, we were betrayed. Diplomacy was betrayed. We were negotiating with the U.S. negotiators. In June, we were supposed to meet for the sixth round in Muscat. And just 2 days before that, the United States and Israel attacked Iran.
Begay defended Iran's response to the ongoing U.S.-Israeli war, saying retaliatory strikes are aimed at defending the country's sovereignty. And he called the U.S.-Israeli war a genocide.
I can call it a kind of genocide. The same day, the same hours that they targeted our leadership's compound at the heart of Tehran, and they assassinated the supreme leader, his family members, including a 14-month granddaughter. They targeted a school in the city of Minab. They killed 181 little angels. What does it mean? That's genocide, because they are killing not only the leaders, but also those who are going to be the future generation of Iran.
A U.S. military review of the school strike cited outdated intelligence as a possible factor in the deadly targeting error. California Congress member, Democrat Progressive Ro Khanna of the Silicon Valley, whose bipartisan war powers resolution seeking to limit U.S. military action in the region failed to pass, is now calling for accountability.
Our missile killed over 175 schoolgirls in Iran. This is the biggest moral crime committed by our military in modern history. Those who are responsible must be held accountable under military law. That means that those at the Defense Intelligence Agency who provided this information must be held accountable. Those at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency who may have been involved must be held accountable.
Khanna also warned modern warfare, increasingly shaped by artificial intelligence, is complicating traditional rules of engagement. He points to previous reporting on the Israeli military's use of an AI-assisted targeting database known as Lavender, which has been linked by some analysts to civilian casualties, including children. As the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran spreads across the Gulf and the Trump administration paints a picture of U.S. dominance, foreign policy analysts say Iran is holding its own, countering the U.S. narrative. Trita Parsi is founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a foreign policy think tank that promotes peace around the globe.
The Iranians are the ones that are currently controlling the Strait of Hormuz. The administration is throwing out a lot of statistics and numbers on number of ships, etc., that have been destroyed. But what is important in a war is strategic victories, not just tactical numbers. And the reality on the ground right now is that the United States and Trump have completely lost control over this war. It is the Iranians that are increasingly defining the geography of this war. Right now, you have the Indians, the French, and the Italians going to Tehran to try to negotiate their own safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. They're not going to Washington to negotiate it. They're going to Tehran to do so because it is Iran that is in control of the waters right now. And that tells you that the administration's goals are not only not being achieved, we're not seeing any strategy on the U.S. side that actually could achieve them.
Of course, yesterday, Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent said the U.S. plans on eventually being the ones to escort people across the strait.
I find that to be very unlikely because that means that U.S. ships, who otherwise have been kept about 3,000 kilometers away from Iran in order not to be able to be reached by Iranian ballistic missiles, would have to be moving much closer to Iranian territory and put themselves in the line of fire. And that, you know, one or two of those ships being hit or being sunk would be an absolute disaster for the United States. So I think there's a lot of rhetoric coming out from the administration that is frankly reflective of the fact that they've lost control.
On the note of losing control, when Donald Trump announced the war, he called on the people of Iran to stand up against their oppressors, against the theocratic rulers of Iran. We're seeing videos out of the country of tens of thousands, if not potentially hundreds of thousands of people rallying for Quds Day and other funerals. What is the sense on the ground there?
Theocracy in Iran has managed to strengthen and consolidate its position. Its own base, which I don't think is much more than 15 to 20% of the population, is significantly energized. Nationalism is really sweeping, particularly that segment of society, but also other segments of society. That does not mean that those other segments do not oppose the theocracy. But priority number one right now is that there are two nuclear weapon states that are bombing the country. And that is what the focus appears to be right now. So this is completely played into the hands of the Iranian government rather than of those elements on the outside who thought that there would be millions of people rising on the streets and overthrowing the government. U.S. intelligence, incidentally, has also come to the conclusion very early on that the Iranian theocracy is not likely to fall as a result of this war.
So then what was the purpose?
Oh, no, this is a completely dumb war. We cannot find the purpose of it by looking at its results because this war was not supposed to happen in the first place. This war does not serve U.S. interest. This was done because Trump had been convinced by the Israelis that this would be very easy and that he could bask in the glory of having gotten rid of this regime that has been in place for 47 years, that would make him a historic figure. And he fell for that. He believed that the Iranians are much weaker than they actually were. And now the United States is put in a lose-lose situation as a result.
The U.S. has talked about a ground invasion. They're in talks with groups in Iranian exiled groups in Kurdistan. What do you foresee there?
Well, I mean, look, if we want to throw good money after bad money, then yeah, that's the path to go down and just to do more of the same, but on a larger scale, thinking that that's going to turn things around. I find it, unfortunately, very likely that that's the direction the administration is going because of a desire of turning this around some way, somehow, miraculously by just throwing more weapons and bombs at it in the hope that the tables are turned on the Iranians and that this is transformed into some form of victory before Trump's own base in the America First crowd actively turns against this war, not just being opposed to it, but really start pressuring Trump on it.
It sounds like it's going to get worse before it gets better.
I fear that it's going to get much worse before it gets better.
So then how do you foresee it ending?
I can see it ending in a negotiation in which other countries come in, that you would have GCC states, Russia and China involved in trying to get some sort of an arrangement, allow both sides to save some face. But I don't think it will be cost-free for Trump. I think the Iranians are not going to agree to anything unless there are concessions given to them. They have leverage right now. They're not going to give it up only to end up in the same situation that they were in, but worse. Compared to what was the case before the war. They're going to use that leverage to, at a minimum, get sanctions relief and put themselves on a positive trajectory. Otherwise, they believe they will be in a state of steady weakening, and that will only lead to the United States and Israel attacking them again in a couple of months.
What about democracy in Iran?
There is no such thing as democracy bombs. And I think we have now once again learned that. Because this is not only a disaster, we're seeing a situation in which the domestic political situation in Iran potentially will be much, much more autocratic and repressive than it was before. The person that they just selected as the supreme leader is someone who has a reputation, whether that is accurate or not, we don't know yet because very little is known of him, but as someone who is even more hardline than his father was. So rather than thinking that this would lead to some sort of democratization, which was, I think, a criminally naive view to begin with, we're most likely going to go towards a much worse situation from the standpoint of internal politics in Iran.
Trita Parsi is founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a foreign policy think tank that promotes peace around the globe. The death toll from Israeli strikes on Lebanon has topped 700 people, including 100 children, according to Lebanon's health ministry. Red Cross and Red Crescent has expressed outrage at the killing, including of its humanitarian workers. In less than 2 weeks of war, a Lebanese Red Cross paramedic helping wounded civilians was killed by an airstrike by Israel, and other medics have been wounded, the group say. Iranian Red Crescent staff and volunteers also suffered casualties aiding civilians. Red Cross and Red Crescent personnel have been killed this year in Sudan as well as Gaza. The heads of the organization said humanitarian workers are protected under international law and must be safeguarded in conflicts. Quote, "When humanitarian workers are protected, so is our shared humanity," they said in a joint statement today. "The lives of our teams and those they serve depend on it." United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke from Lebanon today, urging a ceasefire.
"My message is very clear. We must stop this war. We must have an immediate ceasefire. And my appeal to both parties is, let's do an immediate ceasefire. Let's stop this enormous suffering of the Lebanese people."
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has offered countries assistance to combat Iranian drones that he says Russia uses against Ukraine. Zelensky said at a press conference today that Ukraine has received requests from six countries for drone combat assistance. It's already sent expert teams to three countries, he said, without naming them. Separate requests, which he did not detail, have also come from the United States and Jordan. He spoke at a joint press conference in Paris with France's President Emmanuel Macron and noted providing interceptors was not enough to help fight drone attacks. He said more than 10 countries have already, quote, turned to us for support in protecting against Shahed's Iranian strike drones. These are actually the same strike drones Iranian regime transferred to Russia and taught the Russians to use against the civilian population of Ukraine, Zelensky said. He said the military of Ukraine has expertise in deploying systems. Ukraine has become one of the world's leading producers of drone interceptors. Kyiv offering its expertise to the U.S. and its Gulf partners for the war in the Middle East, hoping to receive in return high-end weaponry it cannot manufacture at home in its defense against Russian aggression. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is temporarily easing sanctions on Russian oil for 30 days for oil that's already aboard tankers. It means customers in other countries can buy the oil without worrying about sanctions punishments. The move is intended to ease concerns over the disruption oil and gas supplies from the Middle East, underlying how the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran has boosted Moscow's ability to profit from its energy exports after sanctions were levied on Russia to curtail its war in Ukraine. California Governor Gavin Newsom said this week there's no imminent threat of Iranian drone attacks in California. After reports emerged, federal authorities warned state officials of threats from Iranian-affiliated actors. An FBI memo sent to local law enforcement and officials contained unverified information for their awareness. According to a White House press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, the memo was one email that was sent to local law enforcement enforcement in California about a single unverified tip. Levitt wrote on social media the email even states the tip was based on unverified intelligence. Newsom wrote on social media he's in constant coordination with security and intelligence officials over potential threats to California. In Gaza, Israeli airstrikes in the Shijaya area killed three people today despite an Israeli ceasefire between Hamas. Meanwhile, the United Nations says Israel continues to block aid deliveries through border crossings. Israel had closed entry into Gaza after its war on Iran, but then said it would reopen at least one of those crossings. That's yet to happen. Here's United Nations spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs tells us that today and yesterday, nearly all humanitarian movements to the Kerem Shalom, Kerem Abu Salem crossings were denied. Only one was allowed through. As a result, we have been able to collect fuel, but nothing else. Our colleagues from the World Health Organization report that they have offloaded the crossing but not allowed to collect, including 50 intensive care unit beds, 170 pallets of medicine, which includes paracetamol, aspirin, and ibuprofen.
United Nations spokesperson Stefan Dujarric. Israel's closed access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the West Bank, considered the most holy site of Islam and Judaism, sparking condemnation of Arab leaders in the region. This at the end of the Ramadan holiday. Eight Muslim nations, including Israeli allies like Jordan, blasted the move in a joint statement, writing that security restrictions on access to places of worship, coupled with discriminatory and arbitrary access restrictions to other places of worship, constitute a flagrant violation to international law. The foreign ministers of Qatar, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey said in a statement. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, released its 2026 civil rights report, documenting a record number of complaints on Islamophobia. Teresa Wersbianska reports.
Corey Saylor, CARE's research and advocacy director, said the organization received 8,683 civil rights complaints in 2025, the highest number since CARE began tracking data in 1996.
We found a number of patterns, and some of those patterns are very important for me to talk about before I get to the data of the report, because they're patterns that impact the Muslim community, but they also affect other Americans as well.
Employment discrimination was the top category, and complaints rose significantly in five states: Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Texas. Minnesota saw a 96% increase, much of it following government actions targeting Somali Americans. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott and Attorney General Ken Paxton launched attacks on Islamic centers, schools, burial practices, and even CARE itself. Saylor said government officials increasingly used what he called, quote, collective and ideological punishment to target citizens and non-citizens perceived as ethnically or politically undesirable.
And so our first argument that we want to put forward to you is that in 2025, what we saw in the United States was a group of powerful public officials assert that freedom comes with conditions. And those conditions that they placed on freedom are you have to speak their approved lines, you have to worship in ways in which they approve, you should trace your ancestry to places that they approve of, and you should think the thoughts that they approve.
One example is the case of Rumessa Ozturk, who faced federal detention and investigation for advocating for Palestinian rights. Saylor said these actions represent a broader trend. Public officials asserting that participation in American civic life comes with conditions, threatening freedom of religion, speech, and dissent. The report also notes a resurgence of anti-Muslim rhetoric in 2025. Efforts in Texas and Florida sought to ban Islamic practices, while federal lawmakers formed the Sharia Free America Caucus to challenge the faith at a national level. Even high-ranking officials spoke publicly about Sharia law, amplifying fears and discrimination. CARE's National Litigation Director and General Counsel Lina Masri emphasized the role of the courts in defending civil rights. She pointed to recent cases, including a $600,000 jury verdict for Muslim men pepper sprayed and beaten while praying in a Missouri prison. Masri said these legal victories reaffirm the Constitution protects the right to religious worship and free speech.
At universities across the country, students and faculty who spoke out about Gaza faced suspension, surveillance, or threats to their immigration status. In several cases, courts have already intervened to reaffirm that the First Amendment protects this speech, even when the speech is controversial. At the same time, we saw government officials use the authority of their offices to portray Muslim institutions and Muslim advocacy as inherently suspicious.
Saylor emphasized that Islam has deep roots in America, dating back to the colonial era and including Muslim soldiers in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. He said attempts to exclude Muslims from civic and religious life ignore this history and threaten the freedoms of all Americans. The CARE 2026 Civil Rights Report paints a picture of rising discrimination, but also highlights the continued importance of courts, public advocacy, and legal protections in defending the rights of Muslims and all Americans to be different and to dissent. I'm Teresa Wersbianska, Pacifica Radio, KPFA News.
Our 77th birthday.
Peace, everybody. This is DJ Sean O, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I wanted to let you know you can check out Soundwaves Radio with host Val the Vandal and myself each and every Friday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles. KPFK.
I'm Christina Onnestad. An official in Lebanon says a man with a rifle who crashed into a large Detroit-area synagogue had lost four family members in his native country in an Israeli airstrike last week. Officials say Ayman Mohammed Ghazali was killed by security after ramming a vehicle into Temple Israel in West Bloomfield Township near Detroit, Michigan, Thursday. The official in eastern Lebanon told the Associated Press Ghazali's two brothers and a niece and nephew were killed at their home in a March 5th airstrike. Ghazali was granted U.S. citizenship in 2016. The FBI is investigating the incident as a targeted attack on the Jewish community. Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer today spoke out against the attack targeting the Jewish community and stressed the need to confront and combat anti-Semitism. Whitmer made no comments about the war.
Yesterday's attack was anti-Semitism. It was hate, plain and simple. We will fight this ancient and rampant evil. We will stand together as we do it, and we will call it out. We must lower the rhetoric in this state and in this country, especially at this moment where we have seen such a rise in anti-Semitism and more attacks on the Jewish community.
Authorities say the suspect is dead after ramming his vehicle into the synagogue, sparking a fire. The synagogue also houses an early childhood center and school. Officials say security opened fire after the vehicle struck the building, striking the suspect, who was found dead in his vehicle, according to the Oakland County Sheriff. Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin said the Department of Homeland Security, which is facing a partial government shutdown at the time, is critical to public safety and must be funded. She noted there's a proposal to separate funding for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from any broader spending bill for the department. She also condemned anti-Semitism.
The Jewish community spends over $1 billion across the country securing their houses of worship, their schools, their institutions. No community in America should be fearful of having their own kind congregate for things like education and worship.
A security guard who was hit by the vehicle is expected to recover, as are the 30 law enforcement officers who were treated for smoke inhalation. Congress member Rashida Tlaib, a progressive Democrat from Detroit, has introduced a measure aimed at protecting journalists and whistleblowers who expose government misconduct and or corruption. Tlaib introduced the Daniel Ellsberg Press Freedom and Whistleblower Protection Act Thursday and discussed it at a forum sponsored by the Freedom of the Press Foundation and the group Rights and Dissent, which is a co-sponsor of the bill.
So we introduced it this morning, the Daniel Ellsberg Press Freedom and Whistleblower Protection Act, because we need to rein in the Espionage Act. You guys know this, we must do it in order to prevent its use and abuse against whistleblowers, especially under fascist regimes.
Her bill's named after Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower who was charged under the Espionage Act for leaking the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War. Ellsberg's son, Dan Ellsberg, joined Tlaib at the forum.
I think he would be delighted, as I am, that this bill is named after him. I don't know if that will help or impede its passage in Congress. But these are exactly the kinds of changes that he advocated for a long time.
The measure would ban the use of the Espionage Act against journalists and their sources seeking to expose crimes or governmental abuse. Supporters say the Espionage Act has become a weapon of choice for muffling the press and punishing whistleblowers. Massive explosions caused by a drone strike at a market in the Darfur region near Sudan's border with Chad Thursday killed 4 people and wounded over 24 others, according to the medical group Doctors Without Borders. It blamed the strike on the army, saying the drone hit fuel reserves at the Adakong border market in West Darfur. The U.S. Senate passed a housing bill Thursday to encourage more affordable and accessible housing, a bipartisan effort that's addressing a growing national problem. The 21st Century Road to Housing Act passed 89-10. The bill seeks to make new housing faster and cheaper to build. It would ban corporate investors from purchasing single-family homes and expand how housing dollars can be used to build affordable homes and rentals. Massachusetts Democrat Senator Elizabeth Warren negotiated parts of the bill after the House passed it, sending it to the Senate.
From wildfires in California to more frequent hurricanes in the Southeast, lawmakers around the country say consumers are finding
this landmark bipartisan bill will help tackle the root cause of this crisis by getting more homes built in every community across this country. It will make sure that families own those homes, not giant corporations looking to jack up the rent and squeeze every nickel of profit they can out of American families. House Republicans should immediately take up this bill and pass it. If they do not, they will have to explain to families across this country in November why they refuse to lower the cost of housing.
The bill heads back to the House, where lawmakers will negotiate a compromise between the two versions. Conservative leader of the House Freedom Caucus, Andy Harris of Maryland, said on a podcast the Senate's version is dead on arrival. A conference process to negotiate a final deal between the chambers could take months. and delay support towards housing for even longer. But a majority of both Republicans and Democrats have embraced the legislation in the Senate amidst a national shortage of home construction and prices that have increased faster than incomes. The bill would give local governments more power with housing, allow banks to invest more in purchasable housing, and lift restrictions on the number of public housing units that can receive private financing through Section 8 funding to renovate properties. U.S. Senator of New Jersey Andy Kim, a Democrat from Cherry Hill, South Jersey, says America's difficult housing situation, but the bill could change housing into a better place.
Housing is one of the greatest ways to grow wealth in this country, yet it is out of reach for so many Americans. Last year, the average age of a first-time homebuyer hit an all-time high of 40 years of age. 40 years old to buy a home. That is not fair or sustainable. Which is why today I am proud to support the 21st Century Road to Housing Act. This bipartisan bill will take meaningful steps to lower the first-time homebuyer age significantly by allowing for the construction of substantially more homes at more affordable prices.
Corporate investors would still be allowed to buy or build single-family homes if they rent them out, but would be required to sell them to an individual home buyer after 7 years, according to the bill. Critics of the provision say large institutional investors being so heavily regulated could lead to less rental housing and higher rents, as landlords would face less competition. U.S. Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii was a lone Democrat to vote against the bill, joining 9 Republicans.
It means all these LIHTC projects are going to die. There is literally no reason to do it this way, and it would take like a 2-line fix. But what we were told last week was, I'm sorry, the bill is closed. I'm sorry, we've been working on this for quite a long time. This is the first time we've done anything major on housing. Let's get it right. Let's get it right. And I don't think people are kind of clocking how bad this is going to be on the supply side. And
it head back to the House next. Lawmakers around the country are speaking out against the skyrocketing cost of homeowners insurance brought on by climate change and related extreme weather events, from fires to floods to tornadoes. Some have launched investigations and are proposing legislation, as Max Pringle reports.
From wildfires in California to more frequent hurricanes in the southeast, lawmakers around the country say consumers are finding it harder to afford to insure their homes. Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, San Francisco State Senator Scott Weiner, and consumer advocates held a webinar on the issue this week. Whitehouse's office has investigated the issue, and he brought hearings when he chaired the Senate Budget Committee.
You're seeing insurance companies go bankrupt. You're seeing insurance companies abandon states. You're seeing insurance companies abandon longstanding customers. You're seeing prices quadruple.
Mark Friedlander is a spokesman for the Insurance Information Institute. It's an insurance industry trade group.
They feel they have too much risk in a certain area. They're going to pull back, and that's going to lead to non-renewals.
33 states saw double-digit homeowners insurance rate increases in 2024. That's according to the Senate Budget Committee report. Non-high-risk states like Nebraska, Utah, and Colorado are also seeing their rates climb. Mark Friedlander says rates in those states have gone up due to things like freak weather events happening more frequently, litigation, and high rebuilding costs. In California, State Senator Scott Weiner from San Francisco said the 2025 Los Angeles wildfires led to many policy cancellations in the state. He's introduced SB 982. He says the bill will make fossil fuel companies pay for the effects of the climate crisis that they've caused.
The bill will authorize the Attorney General to bring fossil fuel companies responsible for climate disasters to court on behalf of the people of California to recover either losses to the FAIR Plan, for a climate attributable event like a flood or a wildfire, or costs paid or to recover costs paid by private policyholders related to climate disasters, including premium increases or investments in infrastructure changes on one's property that your insurance requires related to climate risks, such as cutting down brush near your house or replacing the roof with a more fire-safe option.
Senator Weiner says the bill could lead to up to $3,800 per household in insurance savings for California homeowners. The bill is now making its way through the state Senate. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
After an unexpected fire a year ago, tenants living at 907 Valencia Street say they're still struggling to obtain fire repairs and have adequate living standards. They launched a tenant strike. Brianna Vasquez reports.
Power! 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 Power!
Claiming months of neglect by Mosser, a San Francisco real estate firm, tenants have been working with the House Rights Committee of San Francisco to bring attention to the issues and hopefully pressure the landlord to meet their demands. They say Mosser has not just neglected the damaged repairs, but also blatantly refused the tenants' demands, citing Mosser's lawyers stating, quote, "We will not sign," end quote, when tenants tried to negotiate. Haley Meyerhoff is tenant organizer at the Housing Rights Committee and lead organizer for the 907 Valencia Tenants on Rent Strike.
We're an organization that supports tenants to improve their conditions and to stay in their homes. We fight against displacement in San Francisco area. So it's now been over a year since that fire, and the tenants have received nothing but neglect while they have continued to pay rent checks to Mosser. Right after the fire, tenants heard absolutely nothing from the landlord. There was one tenant who was relocated to another Mosser unit in a different building at the same rate of rent, but 2 months later, in April, they all received temporary eviction notices. They're saying right now, enough is enough. We want the fire damage repaired. We want our in-unit repairs addressed, and we want to be compensated for the time that we have spent living in a building with a giant hole in the wall because of a fire that happened more than a year ago.
Since July of last year, tenants say Mosser has refused to negotiate any agreement between the tenants and has even sent out eviction notices while only giving tenants 45 days to relocate. They say not only has Mosser failed to provide repairs, it has also left tenants to deal with broken appliances and pest infestations in their homes while at the same time renovating vacant apartments. Luz Avila is a tenant at 907 Valencia.
Se hizo una infestación de ratas horrible.
There was a terrible rat infestation, and cockroaches too, and they canceled our mail. We didn't receive mail for almost a month, and there have been many things they have not respected. They have not respected us as tenants, and it's not like we failed to pay rent. They have barely been repairing for a week, but they are repairing the apartments that are empty, and we have lived here for more than 30 years. We still have the same stove and still the same fridge. So now they are more concerned about the empty places than about the tenants who live here. And so now we've made a union of neighbors to go on a rent strike until they hear our demand.
Since the fire incident of last year, tenants say there has been no housing manager in the building to fix these issues or any issues that have arisen since then, leaving many tenants to repair damages on their own or risk months of delayed action by the landlord. Tenants have stated, quote, "This is not just a building. This is our home. This is our community," end quote. And during these next few days, they hope to bring pressure to Mosser and have their demands met. Reporting for KPFA News, I'm Brianna Vasquez.
Correction to a story we reported earlier. Daniel Ellsberg's son, identified as Dan Ellsberg, his name is Robert Ellsberg. I regret the error. A pair of California legislators have reportedly returned campaign contributions from the controversial AI-powered license plate reader company, Flock. The controversial company gave the maximum amount of $11,800 each to State Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas and Assemblymember Buffy Wicks of the East Bay, according to campaign disclosures filed this week. Representatives for both Democratic lawmakers told Politico they would be returning the money amid concerns Flock's data could be accessed by ICE investigators. Privacy advocates have feared the Trump administration has tapped into license plate reader data to carry out its mass deportation agenda. Flock operates a huge network of about 90,000 cameras nationwide. It's been accused in a California class action lawsuit and by some local police departments of sharing its data with out-of-state law enforcement and federal agencies in violation of state law. The possibility of a back door has triggered strong backlash among residents and prompted authorities in places like Mountain View to cancel their Flock contracts. Also, Santa Cruz. San Jose City Council voted this week to impose new restrictions on how the city collects and shares automated license plate reader data, yielding to public pressure, but stopping short of scrapping its surveillance camera network that's partly contracted with Flock. Scott Baba reports.
San Jose City Council voted unanimously to tighten controls over its network of 474 automated license plate reader cameras as the city faces mounting public pressure over surveillance concerns and a lawsuit over its contracts with Flock Safety, a camera surveillance company and automated license plate reader operator. The council's decision reduces data retention from 1 year to 30 days and restricts camera placements near abortion clinics, houses of worship, and immigration-sensitive locations. The new rules also require law enforcement agencies seeking database access to provide additional documentation, including case numbers and crime types under investigation. San Jose Police Chief Paul Joseph defended the technology as transformative for public safety in the chronically understaffed department and the most positively impactful technology he's seen in his 34-year career.
They support the real-time investigation of serious crimes, meaning when something occurs and the vehicle is fleeing, these cameras give us updates as to where the vehicle is in real time to allow us to make a stop. It's assisting us in locating at-risk missing persons. It enhances the coordination between our patrol force, our officers in the field, and our investigation, and our helicopter, our air support unit. And it's also increased the solvability rate for our cases for our detectives.
But the surveillance technology has come under increasing scrutiny in recent months. In November, a coalition of local advocacy groups sued San Jose, alleging the city's practice of allowing warrantless searches of its license plate data violates drivers' privacy rights. Some critics say the council's new reforms don't go far enough. Kimberly Wu is a community organizer in San Jose. Speaking during public comment before the vote, she argued that without better guardrails, the cameras could be used and abused by government agencies, especially in the event of a federal immigration enforcement rollout in the Bay Area.
When the federal government has billions to waste on tearing our families apart, we must refuse to give this authoritarian federal government any AI mass surveillance weapon that will and has already been used to hunt our neighbors. While we appreciate the memos by SJPD and by council members, it does not go far enough. We strongly recommend that San Jose implement all of the community guardrails from this letter, such as permanently ending our Flock contract and ceasing all AOPRs unless and until vendor can meet all of the guardrails, such as requiring a valid judicial warrant for all data searches and prohibiting direct and indirect sharing with immigration enforcement and through fusion centers.
Hui Tran is the executive director of the Services, Immigrant Rights, and Education Network, or SIREN. He said that by their very existence, the cameras are a serious threat to privacy rights.
How many people who have done nothing wrong at all have been captured on these cameras, have had their movements documented, their activities documented, and all of that now stored on servers within the city? These people have done nothing wrong. These cameras track the movements of people regardless of whether or not you're suspected of a crime. We have seen the federal government actively violate the laws that are already there to try to protect our privacy with the IRS, with Medicaid, and more. SIREN stopped one of those events this past year when we sued and blocked the DOJ from getting California's unredacted voter rolls. These active efforts by the federal government show that it is lawless But it also shows that the risk of gathering such data is in itself dangerous.
Earlier this year, three other South Bay jurisdictions, Santa Clara County, Los Altos Hills, and Mountain View, terminated their contracts with Flock Safety amid concerns the company has allowed transfers of license plate reader data to out-of-state law enforcement agencies, a practice that is barred by state law. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
Public school kids in Dublin will return to the classroom Monday after teachers and district officials reached a tentative contract agreement late Thursday night. The three-year deal was struck at about 10:30 following a 12-hour negotiating session and ends a four-day teacher strike, the first at Dublin Unified School District in almost 50 years. Dublin Teachers Association President Brad Dobrensky said in a statement, "By forcing the district to invest in our students by decreasing class sizes and increasing compensation and health care to retain and recruit the best educators for our students, we've made important steps toward the schools our students deserve." The tentative agreement still needs to be approved by the union membership and the Unified School District's Board of Trustees. Matt Campbell, Dublin Unified School District Superintendent of Business Services, said in a statement, "If ratified, the contract would establish a multi-year framework addressing salary benefits, class size, and working conditions. And while neither side achieved everything it hoped for, the agreement reflects a balanced path forward that supports our educators while protecting the long-term stability of our schools and the students we serve." While both sides cheered the agreement Thursday night, district officials caution the cost to implement the deal will likely lead to budget cuts as soon as next year. Some of the agreement's details include a 2.3% ongoing pay hike for teachers effective July 1st of last year, health insurance contribution increases, class size reductions for kindergarten through fifth grade, caseload reductions for speech and language pathologists, and a cap of 45 students for high school PE classes. It also includes a full-time credentialed teacher librarian at every high school and counselors at every TK to fifth grade campus through the 2027-2028 school year. In response to what they say are unfair labor practices at the University of California, amid contract negotiations, 40,000 UC workers, represented by the United Auto Workers Union, held last chance pickets Thursday at all 10 University of California campuses. Teresa Wurzbianska reports.
40,000 ready to fight!
The UAW Local 4811 Union organized simultaneous picketing events at all 10 UC campuses on behalf of 40,000 of the academic workers they represent. The workers say that the UC administration is committing unfair labor practices amid ongoing negotiations for a fair contract that includes increased pay, better job security, and more protections for international workers. 8 months after contract talks began in July 2025, the union voted in February to authorize a strike. On Thursday, workers picketing the UC Berkeley campus marched near the Campanile clock tower, chanting slogans and holding signs reading, "UAW prepared to strike." In a statement, Rafael Jaime, president of UAW 4811, said, quote, "We are holding this last chance picket because we have had enough. At a time when UC should be joining workers to safeguard the future of the university, they are breaking the law and committing a growing number of unfair labor practices. By doing so, they are delaying workers from reaching a full and fair contract that includes job security, fair pay, and protections for all workers, including those from outside the country," said Rafael Jaime, president of UAW 4811. In a statement issued last month, the UC administration said that it was disappointed that the union had voted to authorize a strike. The university said, "Our focus remains on practical progress, continued collaboration, and outcomes that benefit our employees and the communities we serve." For KPFA Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wersbianska.
Three acts of ideologically inspired violence in the last week have laid bare heightened terrorism threat unfolding against the backdrop of the U.S. war in Iran and a counterterrorism system strained by widespread departures of experienced national security professionals at the Justice Department. The firings and resignations, coupled with diversion of resources over the last year to meet other Trump administration priorities, have heightened concerns about the ability to head off a potential surge in threats as a U.S. war with Iran continues, according to a report by the
Associate. Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting...
Danny is an accordionist. He's dedicated his entire life to the mastery of his craft and to the preservation of the traditional music from his locality in North Kerry.
Broken Talkers Bellow. On March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bellow tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony, a man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft.